Bottom line, were the numbers wrong? Do you have any hard evidence that you can present to the American public that these numbers, these revisions that were reported, and there were plenty of revisions under former President Biden, including right before the election, do you have any hard evidence that these numbers were wrong?
Yeah, there is very hard evidence that we're looking at the biggest revision since 1968.
Are you going to present that evidence?
If you look at the number itself, it is the evidence. Like,
no, that's not how numbers and evidence work. White House economic advisor Kevin Hassett.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
Good God.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't. Never is.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yes, I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and on dozens of other fine affiliate stations on both the airwaves and the internets around the country and the world. Blanketing planet Earth, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. I suspect you have already heard the news from late last week that after a dreadful jobs report for July, including huge downward revisions for the months of May and June as well, on the heels of Donald Trump's trade war with the world, Trump simply fired the messenger, killed the messenger, fired the head of the Bureau of Labor Statistics for producing numbers that he did not like. His claim is that the radical revisions for the months of May and June, shaving off the creation of some 258,000 jobs from previous estimates for those 2 months, means that the head of BLS, Dr. Erica McIntarfer, was, quote, rigging the numbers in order to hurt Donald Trump and Republicans. It also included this claim, which Trump also repeated on his failing social media site to justify her firing, as he repeated it again on Sunday to reporters somewhere.
We'll be announcing a new statistician sometime over the next 3-4 days. We had no confidence. I mean, the numbers were ridiculous, what she announced. And if you remember, just before the election, this woman came out with these phenomenal numbers on Biden's economy. Phenomenal numbers. And then right after the election, they announced that those numbers were wrong. And that's what they did the other day. So it's a scam, in my opinion. My opinion is just, it's just additional scam.
Yes, everything is just a scam. I know, Mr. Trump. But in fact, what he just described is not what happened at all. His claim that BLS, quote, overstated the jobs growth right before the 2024 presidential election in order to somehow help Joe Biden, or actually Kamala Harris, is, as political scientist Don Moynihan, I believe, first pointed out, quote, the opposite of true. In fact, as he notes, quote, the large downward revisions to job numbers under Biden, which amounted, by the way, to 818,000 jobs, far more than we saw with Trump's numbers. That revision, that downward revision, actually happened in August last year, before the 2024 election. The bad economic news would hurt the Harris campaign. It would not help them. So Trump is even wrong about that. But we are in opposite world now. More on the firing of the BLS commissioner momentarily, including actual facts about it.
And ooh,
about
facts.
I know, and about those revisions with our guest Valerie Wilson of the Economic Policy Institute joining us momentarily also today. Speaking of unpleasant facts, hi, Desi Doyen.
Hi.
She will have our latest Green News report as the fire that burned down the historic lodge on the Grand Canyon's North Rim earlier this summer has now become a mega fire. And as the Trump administration rolls out climate change deniers and a failed AI report to justify gutting critical climate change regulations.
Fun stuff ahead.
That should be fun indeed. But since all of that sounds just so grim, let me start here very quickly. We don't cover polling data very often on this program, as you know, but I do like to check in every now and again just for sort of a reality check of where things stand, since, frankly, it's getting more and more difficult to distinguish between Trump's propaganda and reality these days. And reality, in this case, will likely help you feel just a little bit better than what Trump's propaganda is offering. To that end, Donald Trump's approval rating has dropped 6 points since April, according to a new poll by the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Now, while 6 points may not sound like all that much, in the poll released over the weekend, Trump has just a 38% approval rating at this point versus a 58% disapproval rating. In other words, Trump is 20 points underwater right now and still dropping in the poll that was taken from July 25 to July 30. Trump also landed lower numbers on key policy issues in the latest poll, including immigration, where he has fallen 9 points since the organization's April survey, clocking in there at just 41% approval, and on civil rights, where just 32% of Americans approve of the job he is doing. He is 26 points underwater in the latest poll there. He also saw slightly lower numbers for jobs and inflation than he did back in April. Of course, the July polling was taken before Friday's job numbers report indicating that the economy is softening and maybe headed for real trouble as his tariffs begin to kick in full in the coming weeks and months. Of course, some polls can be outliers. This one at 38% approval could be an outlier, I suppose, but it matches up pretty well with a recent Gallup poll finding Trump at just 37% approval, the lowest of his second term, the lowest of any modern-day president, I believe, at this point in their term, and approaching his 34% rating just before leaving office at the end of his first term back in January of 2021. He is 38% in the Amherst poll, 37% in the Gallup poll right now. But at the end of his first term, after the January 6th riot at the U.S. Capitol that he incited, in the middle of his failed deadly COVID response, he was at 34%, which he is almost at right now. So even after January 6th and COVID, he was at 34% approval, but 6 months into a second term, he's already at, well, 37 or 38% in the part of most presidents' terms where their approval ratings are historically by far the highest. Even Fox News's own polling has Trump with numbers like 36% approval on things like inflation, as tariffs are driving up prices already, even before they kick in full. So do not be gaslighted by what you hear coming out of the White House or from Trump, or certainly from Trump himself, when he talks about the 80 million Americans who are fully behind him and how America is the hottest country in the world and the economy is the best it's ever been. In fact, just by way of reminder, he won the election last year with a minority of the vote from Americans. The majority of voters voted against Donald Trump, and his approval numbers have fallen slowly but surely ever since. So unless Democrats screw it up, and they are nothing if not good at screwing things up, and unless Republicans can steal enough seats through mid-decade gerrymandering of states like Texas, as we discussed on yesterday's show. But for all of that, it should be a very good year in next year's midterms for the Democrats. But we will see. That's a lot of ifs, and it's a long way to go, but I thought you'd want to know. But this is why Trump is in a panic at this point, sort of make everything seem much better than it actually is in reality as he settles into his authoritarian leadership. And toward that end, no intervening reality, it seems, too small for Trump to try to make disappear if possible. The Smithsonian said on Saturday that it would restore information about Donald Trump's historic two impeachments to an exhibit in the National Museum of American History. They would do so within a few weeks, they said. No rush, I guess. The Washington Post reported last Thursday that in July, the museum had removed a placard describing Trump's impeachment and reverted the exhibit to how it looked back in 2008. That display says, quote, only three presidents have seriously faced removal: Andrew Johnson, Richard Nixon, Bill Clinton. The placard mentioning Trump was removed from the exhibition after what the Smithsonian called a, quote, review of, quote, legacy content. Because I guess history changes. A person familiar with the exhibit plans, who was not authorized to discuss them, told the Post that the placard was actually removed as part of a content review that the Smithsonian undertook following pressure from the White House to remove an art museum director. The Smithsonian denied that claim. They said that, quote, the section in question, impeachment, will be updated in the coming weeks to reflect all impeachment proceedings in our nation's history.
Well, I hope they actually do it.
Well, before it was removed last month, just for funsies, I guess, the placard had been on display since September 2021. It had read, quote, case under redesign, history happens, and it mentioned Trump's two impeachments as well as details about the other three presidents. And then they just decided to remove that for, again, funsies.
Well, you know, it is summer. You can't have all those school children learning actual U.S. history.
You are so cynical, Desiree. Since I guess people need to be reminded about all of this, since the school kids won't find it out at their summer vacation at the History Museum, but I know they're home listening to us. Back in 2019, Trump was in fact impeached by the U.S. House of Representatives for abuse of power and obstruction of Congress for his attempts to pressure the Ukrainian government to launch a fake investigation of Joe Biden. Then, 2 years later, he became the very first president to be impeached twice when the House charged him with inciting the insurrection during the January 6, 2021 Capitol attack. And since people really seem to forget this part, thanks to bad reporting by corporate media, the largest bipartisan majority ever after an impeachment trial in the U.S. Senate found Donald Trump guilty. Guilty as charged, and voted to remove Trump from office by a 53-47 majority. Bipartisan majority, finding that, yes, he had incited the January 6th insurrection. Nonetheless, as a 67-vote supermajority is required by the Constitution to remove a sitting president, both impeachments failed to do that. But yes, a majority voted, a majority found him guilty in the U.S. Senate of inciting a riot on January 6th. In March, Trump signed an executive order to eliminate, quote, anti-American ideology across the Smithsonian museums and, quote, restore the Smithsonian Institution to its rightful place as a symbol of inspiration and American greatness. Apparently, removing history from its halls is what the Smithsonian is trying to do to become a symbol of inspiration and American greatness. In fact, the National Museum of American History spokesperson told the Post that removing the placard was the only change that it had made at the National Museum of American History as part of its content review ordered by Donald Trump. In Saturday's statement, the Smithsonian promised to quickly add Trump's impeachments back to the exhibit. Now, of course, since they've been called out for it by the Washington Post, but we will see how quickly and if that actually happens. So Trump is attempting to rewrite history and reality. Big things and small things in his second term, but his attempt at rewriting the reality of the economy itself, well, that seems to be what has really touched off more folks than usual, or at least more than the number of folks who have been freaked out and angered to date about, you know, the firing of top DOJ prosecutors who were not seen as sufficiently loyal to dear leader, or, you know, infectious disease researchers and climate scientists. Those people go, well, that's a bad thing, but, you know, someone that has to do with the economy, well, that's messed with the economic numbers. Suddenly people are really, really concerned for some reason. And of course they should be. I'm just kind of ticked off that they're not quite as bothered about everything else. Nonetheless, we will discuss some of those reasons that maybe they are more disturbed than usual by this next with Dr. Valerie Wilson of the Economic Policy Institute. I'm Brad Friedman, and you are listening to the Bradcast.
The Bradcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
No, they don't. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Last Friday, the Bureau of Labor Statistics released its monthly report for July. It was not good. Just 73,000 jobs were added over the month, far below expectations from economists, who generally chalked up the slowdown to Donald Trump's erratic and radical trade policies and sanctions that have begun to paralyze businesses, raising doubts about the outlook going forward for the world's largest economy. But worse, from Friday's report, the Bureau also revised radically downward its job number estimates from the previous 2 months of May and June, shaving off a stunning 258,000 jobs off of May and June payrolls, finding that in May, just 19,000 jobs were created and a paltry 14,000 jobs in June. Beyond numbers during the height of the COVID pandemic, also under Trump, such stark revisions in monthly jobs estimates had not been seen since 1968. The drop-off wasn't even as bad during the Great Recession under the previous Republican president, George W. Bush. The Bureau's career statisticians also found that the unemployment rate had ticked higher to 4.2% as Americans dropped out of the labor force and the ranks of the unemployed rose by 221,000. So created 73,000 jobs, lost 221,000 jobs in July. Ever since Trump's so-called Liberation Day announcement of new taxes on imports from virtually every single nation in the world, economists have been warning that the ensuing rift with every U.S. trading partner would finally begin to appear in economic terms this summer. The Friday jobs report appeared to sound that bell, and loudly. Quote, a notable deterioration in U.S. labor market conditions appears to be underway, said Scott Anderson, chief U.S. economist at BMO Capital Markets, noting, quote, we have been forecasting this since the tariff and trade war erupted this spring and more restrictive immigration restrictions were put in place. Daniel Zhao, chief economist at the job site Glassdoor, said, quote, we're finally in the eye of the hurricane. After months of warning signs, the July jobs report confirms that the slowdown isn't just approaching. It's here. All of that, of course, in stark contrast to claims made repeatedly about the U.S. economy by Donald Trump and his administration that it is booming and that the U.S. is now the hottest nation in the world, whatever that means. As Don Moynihan, professor of public policy at the University of Michigan, wrote last week in his Can We Still Govern newsletter, one basic character of the politicization necessary to create an authoritarian regime is that public employees are reluctant to share information that displeases their political bosses. When those bosses can fire them, the incentives to suppress uncongenial information or provide false information becomes overwhelming. Over time, life in these countries becomes bifurcated. Statistics become propaganda. There is an official reality, which many proclaim but few believe, and actual reality. And at some point, actual reality catches up with the fantasy. We have seen examples of this dynamic, he says, already playing out in the Trump administration. Career civil servants have been reluctant to contradict, for example, Elon Musk's false claims about fraud in government or Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s nonsensical claims about vaccines, knowing that doing so would probably cost them their jobs. In certain areas, like environmental policy, the people that produce factual information that the administration dislikes are being fired. But, argues Moynihan, Trump just took his attack on reality to a different level by firing the head of the Bureau of Labor Statistics on the same day that she released July's dreadful data to the public. Why? Well, because he did not like the job numbers her agency produced. Trump's claim is that the head of the BLS somehow, quote, rigged the data. In a long, blustering post on his failing social media site, Trump claimed the report was meant to, quote, make the Republicans and me look bad, arguing we need accurate jobs numbers, unquote, that reflect Trump's opinion that, quote, the economy is booming, in all caps, he said. We can now add economic data to the list of things that Trump claims are rigged against him, alongside court cases, elections, and Emmy Awards, quipped Moynihan, adding, quote, in related news, we just saw the last credible BLS data for the rest of the Trump administration. On that same day, Heidi Shierholz, the president of the Economic Policy Institute, an independent nonprofit think tank that researches the impact of economic trends and policies on working people in the U.S., argued that Trump, quote, directed his team to fire the commissioner of the Bureau of Labor Statistics because he did not like the job numbers that they released. This, she said, is a move straight out of an autocratic playbook. Dr. Erica McIntarfer, the now former head of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, writes Shierholz, is a highly respected labor economist with deep expertise in labor market data. Like all BLS commissioners, she is bound by strict norms of nonpartisanship and statistical integrity. To fire her over an official data release simply because the numbers do not serve a particular political narrative is a deeply dangerous attack on the foundations of a functioning democracy. And she notes it's not just undemocratic, it's also economically dangerous. Joining us now from the Economic Policy Institute is Dr. Valerie Wilson, labor economist and director of EPI's Program on Race, Ethnicity, and the Economy, a nationally recognized source for expert reports and policy analyses on the economic condition of America's people of color. Dr. Wilson, thank you for joining us today on the broadcast.
Brett, thank you for having me. And I cannot say I've ever heard a more depressing introduction.
Well, you're welcome. I got to say, Valerie, you know, we've seen concern and pushback from a bunch of sectors in response to Trump's various firings of, you know, longtime, well-respected career officials at the DOJ, National Institutes of Health, EPA, NOAA, et cetera, et cetera. But the alarm bells ringing Since the firing of the chief of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, who was appointed under Biden, seems to have notched up the alarm bells like we have not yet seen in Trump's second term regarding the idea that the U.S. is officially an autocratic nation at this point. I want to ask you about that. But first, let me just get your sort of top line response to the firing last week of Erica McIntarfer. Have we seen anything like that from any administration when it comes to, you know, straightforward economic data?
You know, I can say, at least in my lifetime and the history that I am aware of, we have not seen anything like this as it relates to economic data. And that firing is extremely troubling. You know, the nation relies heavily on having accurate and timely economic data for making decisions at multiple levels, from the government to business to individuals. And so the fact that that is now put in question, that whoever takes over in that position may or may not uphold those same norms and standards of methodological rigor and reliability and just professional integrity in producing those numbers is extremely troubling.
The revisions to May and June were particularly stark. As noted, we haven't seen anything like that since 1968, and I suspect July's anemic numbers, currently at 73,000 new jobs, that those may also be adjusted down as well in the months ahead once all of the data comes in. Adjusting up or down is not unusual, as I understand it. But do you have any reason, Valerie, to believe that we should be concerned about the veracity of this month's report? In other words, Trump is charging that McIntarfer, quote, rigged the numbers to make him and Republicans look bad. Is there any evidence to support that? And I guess a second part of that, could the head of the BLS actually fudge the numbers if she actually wanted to, as Trump is alleging that she already has?
So first, no, I don't think there is any veracity to the idea that that is happening. And I think it would be extremely difficult for an individual to rig or change the numbers in some way. There are hundreds of people involved in collecting, analyzing, testing, updating, revising those data. And so to think that one person could just, you know, unilaterally change the report is preposterous. And it signals a lack of understanding and awareness even of how the agency functions.
Because it's a whole bunch of people gathering their own sort of portion of the data over time and throwing it into the big pot, right?
Absolutely. And cross-checking and fact-checking and going back and testing it again. And I will add that one of the reasons why there are revisions is to ensure as much accuracy in the data and the numbers as we can possibly produce. They are updated and revised because additional information becomes available throughout the month, and they want to make that information available and reflect that in newer numbers. When the initial numbers are published, they are clearly indicated as preliminary. So no one is ever trying to put this out there as if this is like the final and total and absolute number, but are you know, demonstrating that we will do our best as we get additional information to provide as accurate an estimate as possible. In addition to those monthly revisions, they also do an annual benchmark. Once we do have more actual data and can benchmark those numbers there. So there's constant efforts by multiple people to make sure that data is as accurate and reflective of our current reality as possible.
And it's transparent as well, right? In other words, they show where those numbers come from. Can you dig down into those numbers to essentially check their work if you actually wanted to?
Absolutely. They produce links to technical notes when the employment situation report comes out that you can get into and get into, dig into the weeds there. And I also know from personal experience that anytime you have a question about a data series or particular numbers, at one point when, you know, there were, I guess, sufficient people working there, you could even reach out to folks and ask questions and they would answer them. So they have been incredibly transparent. It's never been about hiding the ball. The other point I will make about those revisions is that it's also the case that as we get nearer to recessions, that revisions typically come in seeming, you know, larger or worse. A large part of that is because some of those data are imputed because they're just not available at the time that those initial numbers come out, that which means those imputations, those estimations are based on historical trends. So as we start to tip over into a different part of the business cycle, as we go from a period of growth to slowdown, the historical data is less reflective of the current data. And so you're going to start seeing larger revisions. So if anything, this just signals that the economic policies of the Trump administration are coming home to roost and are slowing the economy and the labor market in a very real way.
You mentioned, you know, enough people to work there. There have been firings across the entirety of the federal government. And I'm wondering, is there any reason to believe, you know, this stark revision, you know, more stark than we have seen since 1968, can any of that be attributed to the fact that people have been laid off, that the BLS, like all of the other bureaus in the federal government at this point, are doing the same job, but with a whole lot fewer people? Is there any reason to believe that the numbers from May and June could have been so off simply because there are not as many people out there collecting data as previously?
I mean, I don't know that to be a fact one way or another, but I don't think it's too far-fetched to think that that could have some impact on it. You know, as we've said, it, a number of people are involved in this, and we've already heard reports of ways that the agency is having to cut back because staffing and resources are down. I believe there was a story that the CPI, they're going to be collecting fewer data points for that number because of similar reasons. So, yeah, I don't think that's so far-fetched to think that that could also be having an impact.
So, Valerie Wilson, why do you think this firing then has set off such alarm bells? I mean, we've seen previous similar abuses of power from this administration, cleansing the federal government of longtime career officials who were not considered to be sufficiently loyal to Donald Trump. Those, too, were very alarming, even if not surprising in many ways. But this one seems to have caught many off guard or has really thrown folks for a loop among a very broad community, you know, as if there is something different about this particular firing. Is there? And if so, why do you think that is?
I think this particular firing has, you know, raised alarm bells with so many people because of how important and how essential those monthly jobs numbers are in this country. They are like the major news headline every first Friday when they come out. So there's just a lot of visibility around these numbers and these statistics. And we know that a lot of decision makers rely on those numbers, the Federal Reserve, state and local governments, policymakers, businesses. You know, a lot of people look to those numbers to inform their decisions and rely on them, to take them as reliable and accurate and dependable. And so the fact that this seems to be a politicized firing because the president simply didn't like what the report was saying is especially troubling to people who rely on the accuracy of those numbers to make important decisions.
And I want to talk about what that means going forward. But we have seen, frankly, exactly this from authoritarian leaders around the world and in recent times, the firing of chief statisticians. It seems the numbers people are often let go when, you know, dear leader doesn't like the numbers they report. We've seen it in Turkey, Argentina, and elsewhere in recent times.
In support of Trump's firing of McIntyre, the White House posted a fact sheet, and I'm putting the word fact into air quotes here, hard to see on the radio, but trust me, it is headlined, BLS has a lengthy history of inaccuracies and incompetence. Is there any truth to that?
No. At least not that I'm not aware of that history at all. Yeah. And I work very closely. My job is dependent on data from BLS. And so, as far as I'm concerned, there is no truth to that statement.
So moving forward, then, the Bureau is currently, for the moment anyway, being headed up by, I guess, its previous deputy, the second in command, as the interim chief there for now, who happens to have been, as I understand it, with the Bureau, like McIntyre for decades, a career official. Supposedly, he will be replaced soon by a Trump pick. But as Moynihan quipped in the opening that I noted, the July report will be, quote, the last credible BLS data for the rest of the Trump administration. Is that an overstatement by Moynihan?
You know, that's a tough one. I don't want to believe that. And I think we have to wait and see who gets the position and what their background has been.
Well, the reason I'm asking that is because it seems like even if the numbers are accurate moving forward by whoever is tapped to take the job by Trump, it seems like there's going to be a reason now to doubt those numbers because, this is Trump's Trump-friendly person. Even if they're accurate, it seems like it's going to bring skepticism to whatever is reported at this point by the administration. No?
Yeah, I can believe that it would bring a degree of skepticism to how people perceive those numbers and what they think they're saying about the economy. But, we also have other indicators that people refer to in addition to the jobs numbers to try to get a sense of what's really happening in the economy. And so I would say that, we still have other indicators to sort of fact check and confirm against what those numbers are saying.
Yeah.
But it will be very difficult to just sort of take them at face value, especially if they seem to contradict what we're seeing in other economic indicators.
And by the way, who would even take such a job at this point under these conditions, knowing that, if you don't come in with numbers that make the boss happy, you're out? I mean, setting aside, Valerie Wilson, what you may or may not think about Trump's politics, and frankly, I don't know what you think of them, but if that job was offered to you, would you take that job today?
Probably not, no. Although,
yeah,
I would say that it would be a true service to the country for someone with professional integrity to be in that position. As difficult as I can imagine that would be, that would absolutely be the kind of person that would need to be in that job.
I just wouldn't want to be that person no matter
how. I wouldn't want to be that person either. But again, that would be the ultimate service as an economist, as a statistician to this country.
All right. Well, I'll keep that in mind if they come knocking on your door. I know they ain't coming knocking on my door. but William Beach, who served as Trump's first pick as BLS commissioner during his first term, he responded to the news of McIntyre's firing on Friday in a statement describing that firing of his successor at BLS as, quote, a dangerous precedent that, quote, undermines the statistical mission of the Bureau. So how will doubt, even just doubt or even just incompleteness that we discussed, if there's not enough people to gather the data, how will doubt about that data from the BLS specifically affect your work and the type of work that you do at the Economic Policy Institute overall? How much do you rely on those numbers for your work? Or is there, as you said, alternate sources that you can sort of you know, fact check them against, match them up against. Are you crippled by an ineffective BLS, specifically at the Economic Policy Institute?
Absolutely. We rely tremendously on those numbers because the central core of our work is based on the labor market. And I will say, I said there are other, you know, indicators that we can use to kind of understand mm-hmm. how the broader economy is functioning. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the labor market, those BLS estimates are the gold standard. Those are the best labor market at least monthly, mm-hmm. real time as we can get labor market indicators that we have. And so that would be extremely challenging and detrimental to the work that we do, in particular in our ability to sort of go beyond even those headline numbers mm-hmm. and be able to analyze and disaggregate and recognize trends and patterns across different measures. And so it would be extremely disappointing, discouraging, damaging even to our ability to do our work were we not to continue to get good estimates from the Bureau of Labor Statistics.
I've talked to people in other parts of the government, former government workers and so forth, who basically, you know, they've explained that, you know, these career officials who have worked for many different presidents of parties that they may or may not agree with, who have politics that they may or may not agree with, they tend to, when they're in such an administration that they don't agree with, they sort of, you know, keep their heads down and just, you know, focus on the work at hand. But when it comes to something like the BLS, if they were actually, you know, forced to manipulate numbers in some way, do you have any belief that the career staffers there would actually stand for it? Do you think that we would hear about it, that would start to, you know, if bad numbers started to show up, do you think we would hear from the folks at BLS on the inside as to what is actually going wrong? Would you anticipate that?
I tend to think that we would hear from folks. You know, there have already been instances during this administration where, you know, people speak anonymously or, you know, there have been leaks, there are whistleblowers all the time, you know, when there are major institutional shakeups like this. So, yeah, I do believe that there are people on the staff of BLS who take their jobs and their professional integrity and responsibilities very seriously and would absolutely stand up and say something.
Finally, and I suspect much of this, that the firing of the head of the BLS on Friday sort of presents kind of a double whammy for your specific work at the Economic Policy Institute, Valerie Wilson, the work that you do specifically as the director of the EPI's program on race, ethnicity, and the economy. The administration has been gutting any and all anti-discrimination programs they refer to as DEI across the entire government. So, like I said, sort of a double whammy for someone who works on, you know, economics concerning race and ethnicity. Do you count on numbers specifically from the BLS in this area, but also elsewhere in the government that you have seen changed or limited in some fashion since Trump has been on this authoritarian tear in his second term?
Yeah, I absolutely rely on the data from BLS to provide information about what different demographic groups of workers are experiencing in the economy. The headline numbers never tell the full story. There are always sort of underlying trends and patterns that are important to lift up. And in particular, as it relates to the Black unemployment rate, and you know, the fact that we know throughout the 70 years that there have been statistics by race from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, that the Black unemployment rate has historically and almost nearly consistently been about double the white unemployment rate. Mm-hmm. Without that kind of information, I mean, that would not be a point to raise and to continue to sound that alarm. And making that point, I think, has been very important to continuing to press for the kinds of policies and programs that narrow those disparities by essentially erasing that information and pretending that it doesn't exist. It also serves to sort of, I don't know that it really relieves any pressure because the people experiencing it know the reality, but it definitely reduces any pressure or public accountability that can be placed on an administration to address those inequities.
And have you in fact seen the erasure of that information in the 6 months since Donald Trump's back?
Well, you know, fortunately, we have continued to get unemployment statistics by race and ethnicity, although I kind of have been like biting my nails. Thinking, okay, how long are we going to have this? Okay, every month. Okay, yeah, still there. So, you know, what has happened recently really makes me a little anxious about the future of that series. But yeah, there have been other instances where data that we once referred to and were publicly available as it relates to race and ethnicity are no longer publicly available for us to refer to.
Well, your insight here is really helpful, Dr. Valerie Wilson. I hope we get to talk to you more about, well, all sorts of economic issues that we tend to cover on this show. Valerie Wilson is the director of the Economic Policy Institute's program on race, ethnicity, and the economy. You can find their work at epi.org. Valerie, really appreciate you joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Good luck in the days ahead. So, yeah, I really like her.
Yes.
She's really good. We haven't had her on before, but you know when she won my heart?
When?
When she said right at the top, that was the most depressing introduction I have ever heard.
Yes, she does not deny reality. And that's what I was, that's what I got from listening to you guys speak, in that denying reality, as she puts it, the Trump administration trying to deny reality prevents accountability. And it's like, well, of course, yes, duh.
That's the point.
Right. An authoritarian, borderline dictator like Trump, he has to present this false front, and he has to attack the keepers of the truth, the keepers of the facts, the keepers of reality, in order to prevent anyone from holding him accountable. So that's why we get this bizarre, crazy world that we're involved in, where he just, you know, lies on everything, and his administration and many Republicans follow along. It's madness.
You know, you may get some pushback there for calling Trump a borderline dictator.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Not because you called him a dictator, but because you called him only a borderline dictator, which is...
I guess we're going to find out what the line
world
is.
We're in at
days.
This point. Yeah, no, it's fine to call him a dictator. Don't call him a borderline dictator. He's a full-on dictator.
Yeah.
And he is. That is true. But giving him that, we talked a little bit about it on this show before, giving him that that title of dictator, I feel like it takes away my agency in this. Mm. No, he's not my dictator. That's what he wants to be.
That's why he's a wannabe. Gotcha.
Right. I don't want to let him. That's why I call him a wannabe dictator.
I see.
And I'll catch hell for that, too. Anyway, you know the other thing that I liked about Valerie?
What?
She's got no social media contacts.
Yes, good for her.
I know, I'm so jealous.
But you can follow the Economic Policy Institute at EPI on Blue Sky.
EPI.org over at Blue Sky.
Yeah, thanks.
You're right. All right, that's it. Let's take a quick break, and we will come back with borderline good news. I don't know how to describe it. Anyway, Desi
Doyen. The Green News Report.
Yeah, Desi Doyen and the Green News Report is next on the Bradcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Hey, this is Brad. The Bradcast survives thanks to you and your support. Please stop by bradblog.com/donate today to help us continue to do over your public airwaves what we try to do 5 days a week. That's bradblog.com/donate, and thank you. Yeah, not our normal GNR music there, but couldn't help ourselves. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Do you think we can we go into the Green News Report with this jolly music as opposed to our usual?
Gosh, I'm sure we can survive it somehow.
Well, let's try. Let's get to it. Our latest Green News Report.
This is one of the highest priority fires burning in the U.S. right now.
Fire at the Grand Canyon is the largest mega fire in the U.S. New research shows the cascading health impacts of wildfire smoke. Plus,
what do we know today about climate science, about climate data, and what impacts that might have on the American people?
Trump administration rolls out climate science deniers to justify overturning climate change regulations.
All of that denialism and more straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Hope you're having a good summer. It is summer out there. August now and the heat wave. Boy, they say the best thing you can do is stay in a cool, dark place like the Epstein file.
This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, the height of summer, so all the disasters are coming together at once, I guess.
Yes, they actually are. Uh-huh. Extreme weather is striking around the world. In China, Beijing is grappling with another round of extreme rainstorms less than a week after torrential rains and floods across parts of the city killed more than 40 people, including dozens trapped in a flooded nursing home. New York and New Jersey are also cleaning up from intense storms and floods. New York City got 2 to 4 inches of rain an hour last week, but the city's sewers are only designed for a maximum of 1.7 inches per hour, underscoring that America's infrastructure is not ready for climate-intensified extreme weather events. Officials from Minnesota to Maine have issued hazardous air quality alerts due to toxic wildfire smoke drifting across the border from Canada. More than 700 wildfires are now burning across Canada, exacerbated by exceptionally hot and dry conditions.
700 fires in Canada.
Yep. Canada is seeing one of the most severe wildfire seasons in its history, with more than 25,000 square miles burned across the country in 2025 so far.
Well, I guess they're not sweeping their forest floors.
It's driven by prolonged drought and unusually warm temperatures.
What?
Research shows that man-made climate change is significantly increasing the frequency and intensity of wildfires. In Canada, climate change has made extreme heat events up to 10 times more likely, significantly increasing the risk of wildfires.
So it doesn't really have anything at all to do with sweeping the forest floors.
Of course not.
Oh.
In the U.S., the wildfire in northern Arizona that destroyed the historic North Rim Grand Canyon Lodge has reached mega fire status, crossing the 100,000-acre threshold.
Wow.
As we go to air, the Dragon Bravo fire, intensified by extreme dryness, has now burned more than 192 square miles over just the last month. It is now the 10th largest wildfire in Arizona history. It is so intense, it is generating its own weather, creating extremely dangerous conditions for fire crews.
Incredible. And you know, when that fire first broke out, before it burnt down the lodge on the Grand Canyon, fire officials decided to let it burn. They figured it would just burn itself out. Apparently not.
Nope. Inside Climate News reports that as climate change supercharges wildfires, a growing body of research shows the cascading health impacts of wildfire smoke, from lung and heart problems to cognitive decline, due to tiny particles within wildfire smoke that are so small they can penetrate deep into the lungs, heart, and brain. Children are particularly vulnerable. A new study published in June found that exposure to wildfire smoke can even alter the immune system. Finally, in last week's gift to the fossil fuel industry, the Trump Environmental Protection Agency moved to roll back its own endangerment finding, the crucial 2009 analysis that provides the scientific and legal basis for regulating greenhouse gas emissions under the Clean Air Act. The Trump administration justified the move with a hastily prepared new report, authored by prominent climate science deniers, casting doubt on established science. Wired magazine reports that the administration's blatant science denial report also mischaracterized the work of 9 mainstream scientists across different disciplines. They say the report mishandled their work, misrepresented their findings, cherry-picked data, and drew erroneous conclusions. The EPA's proposed repeal of the endangerment finding is now open for public comment, which is helpful to bolster court challenges. Make your voice heard by going to regulations.gov and entering the docket number 2025-14572. That's regulations.gov, docket number 2025-14572. We also have all that info at our website, greennews.bradblog.com.
For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Let's not.
Not ready.
Definitely not.
Not ready. Thank you very much, Desi Doyen. Once again, that's regulations.gov.
Regulations with an S.
And then the docket number is 2025-14572. If you have any thoughts on whether you think basically the government should kill all the regulations that are meant to keep us safe from or mitigate against climate change.
Yes.
Do I have that right?
Yes, you do. And remember David Doniger, we spoke to him previously about this egregious, incredibly stupid repeal of the endangerment finding. And he said that when NRDC, Natural Resources Defense Council, goes to court to stop this, if it should be finalized, mm-hmm. that those public comments, the volume of public comments and the nature of them are incredibly helpful in the courts. So go to greennews.bradblog.com. We also have a little tips on how to write effective public comments.
But just the idea that, you know, there's thousands of comments against this idea and 5 comments in favor of it from ExxonMobil and Shell Oil and so forth, they're the only ones in favor, that will help them in court.
Yes,
when they challenge
and
this.
And believe me, the oil industry, the gas, coal industry, all of their lobbyists, all of those companies, they will be making those comments. So it is helpful for the public to also weigh in. And one last thing about that climate science deniers report that the Trump administration is trying to use to justify overturning it. Not in addition to them misusing and misrepresenting actual legitimate climate science studies, it also turns out that it apparently uses AI.
Yes.
Because several real climate scientists say that the report hallucinated fake studies and authors that don't exist.
Oh, I wish I was hallucinating right around now. Thank you very much, Desi Doyen. Thanks again to our guest today, Dr. Valerie Wilson of the Economic Policy Institute, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. It's always appreciated, always an honor. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other, download it for free anytime at bradblog.com. There is no paywall there. You can share it with your friends, your family, your neighbors, your enemies, and everyone else. While you're there, please hit one of the donate buttons. We'd really appreciate it if you could. Or you can go straight to bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on your public airwaves. Drop me an email. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the social medias, unfortunately, you will find me at The Brad Blog. We will see you there at all of the above. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world. Some like it hot. Some like it hot.